As you're listening to me, Daisy, Apple's iPhone disassembly robot, is dismantling an iPhone into lots of recyclable parts. That's how Apple recovers more materials than conventional recycling methods. Thanks, Daisy. There's more to iPhone.
If you're struggling to lose weight, you've probably heard about weight loss medications like Wegovy or Zepbound, and you might be wondering if they're right for you. Meet PlushCare, a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. If you qualify, they can safely prescribe you medication from the comfort of your own home. To get started, visit plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss. plushcare.com/weightloss.
Every goal, every game, everywhere. The Times and the Sunday Times, now with goals.
Hello and welcome to a specially abridged version of the Game podcast. And you'll note that it's just my voice you'll hear for the next half hour or so, interspersed with Rory K. Smith. Now, the reason is we're not quite like our old boss, Tony Evans, who complained that there was no football when International Week rolled around, but it does feel like a little bit of a buzzkill, or it did feel, Rory, like a bit of a buzzkill going into it, right?
Yeah.
Or were you one of those people who says like, oh, I need a breather from the excitement and quality football?
It's always difficult, this one in particular, because as the club season's kind of getting into the kind of final climax, you then have this lacuna, which isn't really ideal.
Take note, Matthew Syed, lacuna.
No, but you know, everything's kind of building up to this crescendo, and then it just, everything stops for 2 weeks, and it... I don't agree that there's no football during the international break and that it's terrible and blah, blah, blah. It does come at a slightly unfortunate time in terms of the momentum of the season. But it's probably been a more interesting international break than quite a lot of people were expecting.
And in the first part of this podcast, we're going to be talking specifically about that. And England playing Germany. I sort of said, like, yeah, this has got a draw, lots of substitutions written all over it. In the first half, it kind of looked that way, and then Germany were gifted a goal, which probably shouldn't have stood, although the more I watched the replay, the closer I thought. I mean, I still don't think it should have stood, but I kind of give a linesman a pass, especially because he's Italian, of course. But then in the second half, we saw kind of the England that we'd imagined, and we also believed would be really, really difficult to implement, an England that they were fearless, they were moving, they were playing technically good football, and Germany just seemed kind of dozed.
Yeah, I think the thing that, amongst all the triumphalism that kind of got lost, is that the Germans haven't been amazing in qualifying. Their record in qualifying has not been kind of this well-oiled, slick machine. The Irish beat them not so long ago, and no one's talking about Ireland winning Euro 2016. Perhaps wrongly, who knows?
But the Irish didn't play the way English played.
No. But so what I was going to say is that, I think the other thing that was significant was that the German collapse kind of came after they'd started making substitutions. And there is, as you say, there is always that thing in friendlies. Once the substitutions come, everyone loses their rhythm. But the way England played was incredibly encouraging. It was the sort of performance that, like you say, that I think people have thought England could be capable of, but maybe not expected they would be capable of. I think it's the sort of performance that really instills a belief in a team that if you, regardless of the circumstance, if you come back from $2 down in Berlin against the world champions, you're going to start thinking, hang on, we can do this. You're going to have that confidence. England and confidence have a really interesting relationship, which as an outsider you must recognise, that there is this very fine line between not having enough self-belief. The English don't seem to do kind of the right amount of self-belief. It's either not enough or far too much.
Well, I think, I mean, this is a whole other issue, but we can get into it since there's nobody else here.
It's just me and you, Gav. This feels a bit like NPR.
What strikes me, that when you say the right amount of self-belief, I'm always fascinated by this because I think it very much depends on... And while I... Sorry. Let me preface this. While generally, I think football's a lot less homogenous than it once was, I don't think you have these striking differences between countries, I think there still is some level of national id or national psyche. And I think self-belief does matter. And then that is one of those issues. And I think different countries need different levels of self-belief.
That makes sense, yeah.
I kind of think in England, very broadly speaking, English players need to feel confident to do well. Whereas I think, for example, in my own country, in Italy, the less confident we are, the better we do. We have this tremendous fear of failure, which helps you see through, helps your team go through difficult time. Whereas when Italy have been quite good or favorites, they've often kind of stumbled. People always talk about having, you know, the right amount of pressure on them. In England, I think it's a very, very difficult balance to strike. But generally, English players tend to be happier and tend to play better when they're more confident, when they feel strong.
I think that's all absolutely correct. I think the problem with international football can be that you probably need different levels of self-belief, even within a nation, depending on your opponents. So the last couple of tournaments, we've seen England struggle, but certainly 2010, they struggled almost more against... They were given that dream draw, USA, Algeria, Slovenia. And they simply could not find it within themselves to kind of rouse themselves to beat these teams that they were expected to beat really easily. And I think that's the danger, that against Germany, France, Spain, England do need to feel confident.
Okay, we're going out on a limb here, and Rory's no Jonathan Wilson, and neither am I. When's the last
time... We're talking about tactics.
No, actually, I was going to say, when's the last time England beat a top nation in a competitive tournament?
A long time ago.
Is it really a long time ago? Because I was thinking, like, 2014, no. 2012, did you beat anybody good?
Did they beat the French?
He's really not Jonathan Wilson.
No, I think they drew with the French. It'd be early 2000s that they've actually beaten, and obviously in a knockout game, not for a long, long time. Yeah.
Well, I wonder if that almost turns counter to what you just said, though. Because you say, oh, the problem's against little nations, they can't rouse themselves, but then you go out, you have
it maybe
heroic
does.
Defeats against big ones.
But then you get into all the kind of intangible issues. This is going to drive the analytics crowd mad. Things like momentum within the tournament. So if you're off to Italy, obviously the past masters that start in badly and then sort of cranking into gear. England tend to start badly and then get worse.
That's so negative.
I think that what England did in Berlin was really important. It was a really, and there's no question that kind of,
they started badly and came back.
By hook or by crook, there is a talented English generation coming through. That whether it's kind of changing youth development, I don't know. It might just be by accident. But if you look at that England side, there's plenty of young, exciting players. There is reason to be cheerful about the future for England. I'm not an England fan, I should point out. I think that England...
Because your grandfather played for Scotland, is that right?
My grandfather played for Coventry.
But he was Scottish.
First and foremost... No, the Scottish side is the other side of my family. First and foremost, I'm a fan of the Yorkshire national team.
After independence.
Once the rest of the country votes to leave the European Union, Yorkshire will finally be given its rights to be independent. And my international allegiance is to the family.
Will the independent Yorkshire join the EU?
I would like to think we would. I would like to think we would, because of trade I think the issues that face England as a kind of force in major tournaments are more complex than just can we beat the Germans in a friendly. I think that's part of it, and as I say, that result was hugely important, as it will give them, especially people like Dele Alli and Eric Dyer, belief that they can kind of that they can do well against the very best teams, even when the very best team wasn't at their very best. But I think there are more complex issues at stake. And also, you've got to remember that England isn't the only place in the world that has agency. So in a tournament, you get to the stage where it's not just about how much self-belief. Are the English in the right place in terms of self-belief? It's also, are the Germans, are the Spanish, are the French, are the Belgians, the Italians?
Okay, so let's we'll get to Roy Hodgson and some of the choices he's facing in a minute. I want to make a brief detour on Germany here. Obviously, they were the world champions, and... Because we like to go in sort of fads now, the German model is the one to follow. Our friend Raphael Honigstein wrote a good book that I'll plug now called Das Reboot. Very imaginative. But it is a good book. It does illustrate this. And when the FA do the root and branch reviews, which they do periodically when England failed to win the World Cup, they no doubt go and reference this. Before Germany, it was...
Spain.
It was Spain. Before Spain, it was France. Before France, it was Holland.
It's interesting, though, isn't it, that no one ever says, let's follow the Argentinian models, which is to get rid of all institutions and just have people play on the street.
Or to just play kids in your national division because you produce guys who are good enough and you sell them around the world, but whatever else. That said, though, what's interesting about Germany, if you look at it from their perspective, is, A, their record in friendlies is absolutely atrocious. I don't know if anybody went through the trouble. Before you get all excited, they lost at home to the United States, who... As we're recording this, are one defeat away from failing to qualify for the 2018 World Cup. They lost at home to Argentina, which is Argentina, but they still gave up 4 goals. They drew at home with that other world power, Australia. They lost to France, although I think that was away. And as you mentioned, in qualifying, of course, they lost to Ireland.
Drew with the Scots, didn't they?
Yeah, this is all pretty bad. And I look at the German team as well, and... After Hummels came off, and Hummels is a guy that he has a special place in my heart. I absolutely love him as a player, but he's got enormous flaws as a defender, which are obvious to anybody who actually watches him play every week, even though he's doing better than he was a year ago. Once you get past Hummels, you have Jonathan Tah, who I think has got a great future in the game, but his present, his international level, not quite the same. And then they brought in Antonio Rudiger. Now, Antonio Rudiger plays for Roma in Serie A. He's phenomenally athletic, but nobody would look at him and say, I mean, like, for him to get into the Italy side, he would have to go and wear a Giorgio Chiellini mask. There's just no way, right? He's got enormous flaws. And I look at that, but then I look up front, and up front, it's Mario Gomez, who's scoring a bazillion goals this year in Turkey after having had two horrendous seasons at Fiorentina.
Probably through injury.
In Serie A. Yeah, no, but even when fit, he wasn't good. But more importantly, he's a target man mm-hmm. who needs a certain type. He doesn't really fit. But yet Yogi Löw has to call him because his other strikers are Kevin Folland, who's been described as being promising for years. Mm-hmm. Mario Götze, who might have scored a goal in World Cup final, but isn't a center forward and regardless can hardly get off the bench at Bayern Munich. I mean, myself, we're at like peak Germany, right? Mm. They're producing all these phenomenal players. They just can't seem to produce centre forwards and centre backs. Well, what's up with that?
The one name you've forgotten, obviously, is Jerome Boateng, who is...
Right, he's injured.
He's injured, but...
But he's also 27. I don't think he's a product, necessarily, of this revolution. Boateng can be the outlier,
you
right?
You can make an argument that Boateng's the best central defender in the world.
I will make that argument. Boateng and Bonucci, for me, are the two best central defenders in the world. But what I'm saying is, it's kind of extraordinary, right?
Yeah, but this is...
When you look at the depth they have in other positions.
This is a fascinating issue, and I think Germany's probably just a really kind of extreme example of the tendency now, and Wenger's spoken about it a million times, Miguel Delaney has written about it a million times, of the tendency now of European academies, particularly in kind of places like Holland and Germany, and I would say England as well, to churn out technically gifted midfielders. That is where the emphasis is. Anytime you speak to people involved in youth coaching anywhere in Europe, and they say that the tendency is, in academies, once you see that you've got a player at whatever age, 10, 12, 13, who is obviously a gifted footballer, they tend to drift into one of those midfield roles. So you get this overbalance between midfield and defence and attack. Wenger says that the only places that are sort of creating strikers and central defenders is South America. I read something this morning in a paper that is published not far from where we're sitting now and is a broadsheet, which said that Hodgson will take 5 strikers. I think you don't take 5 strikers. I think you take 4 strikers, and you say that if you really need a 5th striker, you have Theo Walcott.
Here's the issue I have with such pronouncements. When we talk about strikers, we presume Hodgson will play 4-2-3-1.
That's likely, yeah.
A guy like Welbeck, do you consider him a striker? Do you consider him a winger? What's Sterling?
Sterling counts as a winger. Sterling won't play up front for England.
Okay, so Sterling's a winger. Is Welbeck a winger?
Welbeck's a tricky one. Welbeck will definitely be in the squad.
Well, does he count against your 4 or not?
My 4 would probably be, not that necessarily I would, but I think Hodgson will be Kane, Rooney, Vardy and Welbeck.
So no Sturridge?
I think he might take Sturridge because I think he might take 5, but I think taking 5 strikers, even if you're playing 4-4-2 or 2 up front, I think 5 strikers is excessive. 1 man up front a lot of the time, or some of the time, you definitely don't need 5. It's silly. You need options in other places. And England are lucky that they have people like Welbeck and Walcott who can fit into lots of different roles.
It's really interesting in terms of the number of people to take because I remember France, I don't know if it was 2014 or 2010, they took 3 centre-backs. And there was an argument, there's a guy named Jonathan Liu who writes for The Telegraph, and he made the point that because centre-back pairings, you tend not to substitute your centre-backs, it doesn't make sense to bring your 4th centre-back because that guy will never play. And, you know, and he provided a lot of data, whereas people tend to substitute strikers for a million reasons. The problem I have with that logic is that when one of your center backs is missing, and over the course of 7 games, the likelihood of one guy gets injured, one guy gets suspended, all of a sudden, you either have to put a midfielder there or you're screwed. And then it becomes a disastrous eventuality. It's almost like insurance, right? It's almost like the reason we bring, you know, why bring a 3rd goalkeeper? That dude's never going to play, right? So I kind of feel that you have to bring 4 centre backs.
Agreed.
And if you want to count Stones as a right back, and you know, but look, but you can play centre half, fine. So of course that takes away from your flexibility among the strikers.
I think the one thing that maybe England do have is players who can fill in. So if you
Milner, you're talking.
Well, no,
play a million positions.
Well, Milner can. I think on form, Milner probably doesn't deserve to go. I think he'll be captain. We're recording this Tuesday afternoon. I think he'll be captain against Holland, which suggests that he is going to go. I'm not sure that as a first choice, if you were to pick 4 central midfielders or even 5 central midfielders, Milner would necessarily get in on form, but I think Milner will go partly because of his versatility. But if you take right back as an example, Klein is the first choice. I think Stones can play there. Milner can play there. Eric Dier can play there. So I think there is a versatility which gives them, but against Slovakia,
Paddy Barkley wanted Flanagan at right back.
That is incorrect. It's correct that he did. It's an incorrect shout. Are you wearing tights?
What? No, these aren't tight. This is Lycra. I'm wearing shorts over them.
Why are you wearing Lycra?
Because I walked here this morning.
I see. This is
from my home in Chelsea. Yes.
Yes, I see. Very good. That's admirable. I got the train. And I'm wearing jeans.
It's because you live in Manchester. I live in Manchester. It would have taken you much longer to walk here.
So I think England are fortunate to an extent that they have that flexibility. And that might mean that Hodgson can, for example, take away the specialist right-back that he might take as substitute to Klein. Although that's harsh on Kyle Walker. And take an extra striker, right. In which case, fine.
Oh, it's Klein, Walker, it's all boring. Let's talk Rooney, which is far more interesting.
No. The Rooney debate's not a debate. Rooney's going. Rooney will probably play if he's fit. He's the captain. Rightly or wrongly.
Are you satisfied with that approach?
No, because I don't think... I think one of the things that is sort of holding them below the waterline for too long is that they have this tendency that it's a really sort of retro tendency that most countries have grown out of selecting the best 11 players rather than the best 11. And I don't think Rooney's necessarily in the best 11. I don't think Rooney gets
into... Is he one of the best 11 players?
If you don't select the best 11 players, you probably don't play central defender because they're not as technically gifted as all the attackers. I think there's definitely been a kind of seduction by Stardust for England managers. And I thought what was really encouraging about Berlin was that because of Rooney's injury, Hodgson seemed to hit upon a team that had a sort of distinct style and that worked without Rooney in it. So I think Hodgson's got a really difficult decision to make, but there's no question if he's fit that Rooney goes, and I think it's 95% certain that if Rooney's fit and he's in the squad, which he will be if he's fit, then he will play because he's the captain.
I want to throw two concepts out to you. One is that there is a whole history in major tournaments of guys who miss most of the season through injury or bad form or whatever, and then they start getting fit in like April, and then they go in and they have monster tournaments.
Yep.
Especially good players.
I can buy that. Yeah.
We've seen that. So it could be that Hodgson's thinking of Rooney fitting into that category. But there's an interesting concept, which Graziano Pelle spoke about this vis-a-vis Conte. Italy have kind of had to do this because we don't have good players right now. We have maybe half a dozen good players and the rest are pretty meh. But this idea that you pick your team for your two-year cycle and you say, this is my national team, and it becomes like a club side. Mm. You tell the guys, if you're fit,
VoiceOver describes what's happening on your iPhone screen.
VoiceOver on. Settings.
So you can navigate it just by listening.
Books. Contacts. Calendar. Double tap to open. Breakfast with Anna from 10 to 11.
And get on with your day. Accessibility. There's more to iPhone.
There's never been a faster or easier way to start your weight loss journey than with PlushCare. PlushCare accepts most insurance plans and gives you online access to board-certified physicians who can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Take charge of your health and speak with a board-certified physician about a weight loss plan that's right for you. Get started today at PlushCare.com/weightloss. That's PlushCare.com/weightloss. PlushCare.com/weightloss.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
You'll always be called and you'll always have a chance to win your starting spot. You don't have to worry about that. And then maybe you add in a couple guys if there's major injuries or losses of form or whatever, somebody. But Bellet talked about how that took all the pressure off him vis-a-vis Italy. And so he's produced more and played better when he's had to play for Italy. You know, he's in competition for his starting spot. But there's never any question of him going. That seems to me the opposite approach to what's been taken in England and the opposite to the conventional wisdom. And again, maybe you can get away with it if you're Italy because, you know, it's kind of like, do I call this mediocre player or that mediocre player? But I just wanted to know what you thought about that. And given what you said earlier about the England players all lacking confidence and whatever, if there isn't some element where these guys underperform when they play for England because so many of them are looking over their shoulder. So like Cahill's looking over his shoulder. Smalling, Klein, all these guys, right? Then nobody said to them, you will definitely start. And maybe what he's doing with Rooney is saying, like, look, Wayne, you're playing.
The thing is that I think there's, with picking an international team, there's so many different ways you can do it and there's so many different choices you can make about kind of your policy. I'm not sure that one is right There's not like a one-size-fits-all system.
Yeah, there never is. There's pros and cons with each one.
So you can say, like, it's best to wait until kind of April and then say, right, who is in the best form, who's at the peak of fitness, all that stuff. Let's build a side around them because they'll have the momentum, they'll have the confidence. You can take the Conte approach, which is kind of, here are my 20 guys. I think he said today he's got 16 certainties. These are the 16 core players that I will take. And then the other seven are kind of...
Yeah, they're the same 16 dudes that it was 2 years ago.
All of them are Roberto Soriano, that's fine. Yeah, there's that approach. You can, let's find a system to cram in the 11 most famous people we've heard of, which was how England was run between 2000 and 2012. Or you can say, right, we're actually going to sort of find the core of a club side, or we're going to take, you know, these players, does this system work for this player to get the best out? There's loads of different ways of doing it. I think that there is a balance to be struck. I quite like the idea of an international team being run like a club side. As I say, I don't think any of them are wrong. I don't think any of them are perfectly right.
But then there'd be no room for like a Sturridge or a Vardy.
In a club side, if a youth team player is on hot streak of form, then you find a way to cram them in, don't you? You find a way to adapt your plan to what is...
A couple guys in, you can't cram like 10 people in.
Realistically, you're not going to get, in the course of a two-year cycle, you're not going to get 10 players who suddenly hit this incredible streak of form. England have kind of Vardy... Kane, kind of, but not... But Kane,
Ali
and Vardy are the two, and maybe Dyer are the two or three who've kind of really emerged over the sort of unexpectedly over the last year or so. Even Kane, who's a relatively...
So then if you're Henderson, you look over your shoulder and you're like, is this guy coming from my
spot?
Yeah,
but then you've got that argument about, is it better to have... Does it undermine you if you're not sure about your place, or is it better to keep you on your toes? And different managers will tell you
different
things.
There's a broader argument too, maybe one for the analytics people. Does it really make any freaking difference if it's Henderson or Ali sitting in front of the back four? Sorry, Henderson or Dyer.
It probably doesn't make a huge amount of difference, I guess. It's easy to be fooled by perspective and short-term memory. But yeah, it probably doesn't make a vast amount of difference.
It's been a bit of a melancholy weekend, and not just because they took our Premier League away from us, but obviously football lost one of its greatest ever players. A lot of people, including myself, have argued that he's perhaps the most influential footballer of all time, not just for what he did as a player, but afterwards as a coach, even though that only lasted 10 and a half seasons, but really as a figure in football. That was, of course, the passing of Johan Cruyff last Thursday. I went back and I looked at some YouTube of them. There's one guy who made it's exactly 14 minutes long, which is rather fitting. And it just set to music, just Cruyff playing. And it struck me that one of the many remarkable things about Johan Cruyff was that, as a Cruyff the player, that is, he was unlike anything that came before. And what I admired most about him was he had this incredible athleticism to him, which, you know, some people say, oh, it's like a bad word, you know, but he could do things with his body that other people could not, and other people had not done before. I mean, he really was outside the mold as a physical specimen.
I'm too young to have seen. Did you see Cruyff play?
No.
So I remember the Barcelona Dream Team in 94, the one that tonked Manchester United, and that being my kind of footballing education and thinking, oh my God, that was like football in England in the early 1990s did not look like a lot of fun.
Especially but, where you lived, where it was all Carl Schutt and
Jerry
Speed.
Oh my God, let's not get started about Carl Schutt.
Chapman.
Schutt and Chapman. What a strike force. And still name that league.
Chris
team.
White. Nigel Martin.
Chris
White. Kind of good.
No, Martin came later. John Lukic was the title winning keeper.
Regardless.
And a lovely man, John Lukic. But no, Cruyff, yeah, I agree with you completely. He's the best player that Europe's ever produced.
And we should remind everybody that Eusebio was born in Mozambique, yes. And Beckenbauer is a defender. And Cristiano, before Duncan gets bent out of shape, we're leaving you out of the equation because your career isn't over yet, and you've got many, many more glorious chapters to write.
Exactly. I would actually say that, and again, it's impossible to judge across the ages because it's not far off a different game. Eusebio, I also obviously never saw play. I would say that Cruyff was a more significant figure in football history than Eusebio, although Eusebio was enormously significant. You know, it's not a zero-sum game. But Cruyff, certainly as a manager, his conception of football, I think, is what made him stand apart. But there's two things that have really interested me, and it's 5 days after now since he died. And sort of having absorbed so much of the coverage, and there's been so many different types of tribute paid to him, and it's actually quite moving. Football does saccharine very well, but occasionally it gets the pitch just right, and I think a lot of the tributes to Cruyff have been not far off. I think it's interesting. Cruyff didn't invent the Cruyff turn. This is a massive misconception. It's not like before 1974 World Cup and Jan Olsen, no one had ever flicked the ball between their legs. I think what Cruyff did, and this ties in with the athleticism and his elasticity of movement, his suppleness, no one did it with that grace on that stage, at that speed, and with such kind of elan. I think that's why it's called the Cruyff turn. Is there another player who's got a trick named after them? I don't think there is.
Not globally. Right, we stand to be corrected, and please let us know if we get this wrong. But
you've got Chilena, Olimpico.
No, I mean, but you know, there's Zidane's Roulette, but, you know, again, he didn't invent it, but it's not called the Zidane.
It's just all, yeah. And on Pro Evo 1997, the act of doing two stepovers was called a McManaman stepover, which I thought was very ambitious. but Cruyff, that was what he did. I think he took the artistic side of the game to new heights, and he showed in a sport that was kind of suffocating a little bit with Catenaccio, with Herrera, with kind of the muscularity the Brazilians were adopting, Cruyff injected, and that total football team. Although, as Simon Cooper would tell us, it's actually to be called Hollandsche Steel, I think, is the actual title. They never called it total football. And he injected that beauty back into it. And then that continued throughout his career as a coach. But the other thing that's been looked over with this desire to kind of characterise him as a pure artist, Cruyff was a winner. Like, Cruyff wanted to win. That was, if I spoke to Miguel Angel Nadal the day he died, and he said the first thing that he did was teach Barcelona how to win. That as a player and as a coach, he wanted to win games. There's a quote from him that the first thing he did when he took over at Barca was sign four Basques, because Basques aren't afraid of anybody, and he wanted the opponents to know that that Barcelona were going to give them hell. And I think that's a side to Cruyff that is easy to overlook, that everything, the beauty, the artistry, the craft, the guile, came about through winning. I think Cruyff would want to be remembered as a winner. I tweeted last week that my favourite Cruyff quote is that he, at 4-0 down, he said he always tried to hit the bar because it was more fun for the fans to go ooh than just to sort of clap and cheer another goal. And that's always used as kind of evidence of his artistry, his artistic heart. They were 4-0 up at the time, and that's really important.
I want to touch upon something which I learned a long time ago, that the single biggest lie or perpetrated on the footballing world is this idea that history remembers the winners. And for me, Cruyff is the ultimate example of that. I always mention the fact that probably the four best teams I've ever seen at the World Cup were, in reverse order, Brazil 82, Holland 74, Brazil 70, and Hungary 54. And only Brazil 70 actually won the World Cup, and yet those teams loom so large. People, despite the fact that they made a movie out of the Germany 54 team, people remember very little about that other than some pretty nasty stuff, which we won't get into. But they remember that Hungary team. The Holland 74 side, Cruyff came out and afterwards, there's a quote where he basically said that, you know, we won because people remember us and they won't remember them. And to some degree, despite Beckenbauer and Zep Meyer and all that stuff, it's kind of true. Yep. We still talk about this. We don't talk about Germany 74.
No, but it's also the influence that team had on the game, isn't it? It's the influence that we still feel.
Here's my question, though. What I don't get about Cruyff was, if Cruyff had been born in England or if he'd been born in Italy, what fascinates me is, there was obviously a before, but you always need certain conditions, right? So Cruyff wasn't born raised into a great footballing culture. And I wonder if, A, because Holland's weren't Holland in the mid-60s when he started making his debut, started making a name for himself. So I wonder, A, if in some ways that helped him, the fact that, you know, it was almost like a blank slate and he was writing Holland's history. But also if he was extremely fortunate that he ran into Rinus Michels, who, of course, a lot of people credit as the father of total football, or whatever Simon Cooper called it.
Hollandsche Steel.
Exactly. And maybe if he'd been born in Brazil or if he'd been born elsewhere, he would have developed separately. I remember Michels giving an interview where he said that Cruyff helped sell total football, that philosophy would have still been there. It would have still been successful to a point, but it might not have been as emulated or as accepted, and the ideas might not have percolated elsewhere as efficiently if he hadn't had, you know, the world's greatest player at the time playing in at the heart of it.
Yeah, it's the old debate about how many great skiers are born in deserts, isn't it? That if Michels had conceived a total football but not had the generation to play it, then it wouldn't have worked. And I think that's absolutely true. And particularly, you need that symbol. You need that sort of, that sexy symbol, there's no better word for it, I think, to seduce the general public. And Cruyff was that. And then all the others, Nations and Johnny Rep, they all kind of fitted in around Cruyff. But without Cruyff, maybe it doesn't happen. I agree with you completely about the blank slate aspect of it, that I think if he'd been born in Brazil or England or Germany or Italy, where there was kind of a strong football culture, he would have, I guess that there would have been a risk that he'd have been made to fit a profile rather than being allowed to develop his own. That's probably really important. But it's nature and it's nurture, because Vic Buckingham, who was one of his first coaches, I think his first coach who gave him his debut at Ajax, and brought him into the youth setup. Buckingham said that he never took any credit for the style, but Buckingham was a very kind of forward-thinking coach, and he wanted to encourage a sort of pass-and-move style. The sort of lineage of it is from Tottenham's push-and-run in the 50s through to total football is undeniable. And Buckingham encouraged it. He never took any credit, but I think the fact that it could have been that, you know, Cruyff might have come into an Ajax team who'd been taken over by a disciplinarian coach who wanted to play a much more kind of robust system, but he didn't. He turned up at a club that was right for his style of football. It fitted perfectly. Wherever he was born, whatever he'd become, Johan Cruyff would always have been an extraordinary footballer. He might just not have been the sort of totemic figure that he became.
I think arguably there have been three huge tactical leaps forward that have been emulated and have actually...
This is the Jonathan Wilson bit. Let's go.
In the last half century... The three big sort of tactical light bulbs have been total football, Sacchi's Milan, and Guardiola's Barcelona. And what's remarkable is that Cruyff played in one, was the architect of one. Arrigo Sacchi has never hidden the fact that he was inspired and he took a lot of his ideas from total football, but also the Ajax side of the mid-80s that Cruyff coached. And of course, Pep Guardiola, I mean, I remember going to see Pep in Qatar back in 2004, where he said that, you know, if he had never met Johan Cruyff, he would have never become a top-flight footballer. He would have been some schlub in the third division passing the ball sideways over and over again. And this was before he became Pep, the commodity manager. So I think for those reasons... there's no question we had one of the most influential figures in history. And there was, I don't want to say necessarily a dark side, but obviously with every yin, there's a yang. I am also completely fascinated by this man's terrifying stubbornness. One story that I was reminded of is 1982. His career is nearly coming to an end, or it is basically at an end. He's 35 or whatever. And he wants a new contract from Ajax to play one more season. And Ajax say, Johan, we can pay you this much. We can give you 1 year. And he says, no, I'm worth more than that. And what does he do? He walks out and he joins Feyenoord, their arch rivals. What does he do at Feyenoord? He has, obviously not the best season of his career, but he has a tremendous season, scores double figures in goals, and Feyenoord win the double. And that is how he walks out of football. And because he's still Cruyff a year and a half later, he goes back and he gets the job as manager of Ajax. I don't know many people who can do that. You know, imagine Steven Gerrard at the end saying, oh, no, guess what? I'm going to go play for United next season. Then 2 years later, I'm going to go and replace Brendan. It's hard. It's impossible to wrap your head around stuff like this, isn't it?
And it is the sort of the way the game's drawn. This sounds like an old man's complaint, but the way the game's drawn makes it impossible. Like, it probably was not impossible. 70s and 80s, possibly before that. But no, there's no question that Cruyff's kind of strength of character is an indelible part of his legacy. You know, that the cliche that Dutch players are all strong-headed and all that and strong-minded and strong-willed, that comes from Cruyff. All that comes from Cruyff. He was the first brand player. One of my favourite things about Johan Cruyff is the two stripes in 1974, because he wouldn't wear an Adidas kit because he had a sponsorship deal with somebody else. Was it Puma?
I don't know.
I can't remember. But he had a sponsorship deal with somebody else, so he won't wear the two-stripe kit. And the quote is that everyone knows that the third stripe is Cruyff himself. And he was. This is the early late 60s, early 70s. He was powerfully aware of his brand. And if you look at kind of... it's not just that Cruyff created huge swathes of modern football. I think Cruyff created a vast part of the modern footballer as well.
Would Van Gaal be the way he is without Cruyff?
Nothing would be the way it is without Cruyff.
Which is it's just fascinating. I mean, and I was obviously he issued a statement. We'll never know because of the relationship between two people, one of whom is gone, the other one's pretty private, headstrong person. But I wonder if that dichotomy, that really genuine bad blood which existed between the two for so long and no doubt was based on tremendous respect. I just wonder though, and I'm gonna get all philosophical here, but when you're about to die and you're facing the prospect of your immortality, does that make you wonder, you know what? Is it really worthwhile keeping grudges? Is it really, are all these sort of 20, 30 years of acrimony really worth it? Thank you for joining us for this rather different game podcast. We'll be back next week at a normal time with normal people and no Rory K. Smith.
Your subscription to The Times and The Sunday Times now comes with access to every Barclays Premier League goal. Refresh your app, choose your team, accept notification, and you're away.
Thank you for downloading. To discover more, head to thetimes.co.uk.
The train is now approaching. Junction at platform. Passengers, airport, please stay on board. Next stop, road station.
iOS helps you control which apps you share your exact location with. There's more to iPhone.
Small details or big surfaces, tight corners or odd shapes, flat, rounded, textured, or tall. Whatever your next project, there's a spray paint pattern that's just right. Because Rust-Oleum's new Custom Spray 5-in-1 gives you control with 5 different spray patterns. So you can tackle nooks, crannies, edges, and curves without worrying about drips, runs, uneven coverage, or anything else. Custom Spray 5-in-1. Only from Rust-Oleum.